Thank you all for coming. Grateful to Dennis, who originally invited me, but alas, is ill today. So I hope he has a speedy recovery. Thinking about the will of the people and how the will of the people gets expressed, I don't think we can stray too far from the Brexit issue, which was another attempt to gauge the will of the people through a non-parliamentary route. And so there are some interesting parallels, I think, between petitioning and referenda. And therefore, in a sense, I think there's a sort of pre-modern precedent in the petitioning that I'm going to be talking about. And many of the same issues about the relationship between Parliament and the people and the nature of the democratic process are inherent in the debates over petitioning, just as they have been swirling around ever since Brexit. And petitions and Brexit, of course, came together, a massive petition of over 4 million calling for a second referendum, and then more recently still 2 million against Trump's visit. So petitioning seems to be in some ways in revival, but again, they've attracted a lot of criticism, and in many ways they're problematic, and I want to come back at the end of the talk and just think about the e-petitioning that we engage in now and how different or similar it was to what went on before. But I think the government's response to the big petition against the Brexit result was interesting. The Act did not set a threshold for the result or for minimum turnout. That was the official response to the petition. Perhaps a good question is, why didn't it? But anyway, the threshold and how many people actually are needed to express the will of the people, again, is something which comes up in petitioning debates. And the Justice Secretary, Liz Truss, said in relation to Brexit that it was the settled will of the people. And I was rather puzzled by that statement, really, and I wondered whether there is ever such a thing as a settled will of the people. And got me thinking about the way in which the history of petitioning problematizes that whole notion that there's a fixed, settled will of the people. It seems to me that the history of petitioning suggests a rather dynamic process, one in which the will of the people is contested, and therefore politics is a process of contestation, not something which is fixed and settled. But I think we could perhaps also think about the ways in which petitioning either enable or assist a certain type of political culture to emerge and to embed. And so one of the things I want to convey in this talk really is how much public participation there was in the pre-modern world through petitioning. And that in the era before mass elections, petitioning was very much the way in which the public routinely participated in political culture and in some ways in negotiating social relations. And that petitioning process, and because of its quite extensive participation, raised all sorts of really interesting key questions, political questions, questions about how one organises politics, but also about what were the rights and extents of the rights that were involved in the people, for the people who were involved in that petitioning process. So I want to try and unpack some of that during the course of the talk. I'm mainly going to be talking about petitions as they were directed to Parliament. But I want to stress right from the very outset that petitioning was, in the pre-modern world, a ubiquitous way of getting things done, irrespective of whether it was being directed at Parliament. Indeed, I think in many ways, petitioning is sort of intrinsic to the way in which politics worked at the parish pump level as much as it did at the national level. Across the country, across parishes, across counties, across local institutions, we can find petitioning involved just in the way that we can find the people petitioning their national representatives. So it's one of those really interesting practices which is, in a sense, links both the local and the national. The other very interesting feature about it is that it's available for a very wide number of issues. It's infinitely adaptable to almost any circumstance. Almost any topic can generate, and did generate, petitions. And so long as you had somebody to draft the text of the petition, they were pretty widely accessible. You didn't actually need to be literate in order to put your mark to the petition. So they have many virtues of flexibility and accessibility. In some ways, they also allow people to impersonate other people. Here are two petitions, one claiming to be the women's petition against coffee. This is a sort of satirical one, suggesting that actually, if only men drank more liquor and alcohol, their lusts would be inflamed, and the problem with coffee is that it's, you know, so much more sober. So there's potential for satire and entertainment in the petitioning form as well. So I want to start with just giving a very brief overview of the history of petitioning, which is an extremely long one because, as I say, it was so intrinsic to the way in which things got done in the pre-modern world. There was a project run out of York University, which looked at 17,500 petitions, which are located held in the National Archives, presented to the English Crown between the 13th and the 15th centuries. And the conclusion of that project was that petitions represent the authentic voice of the subjects of the medieval English state. So even before the period that I know most about, the early modern period, petitioning had a very long tradition. In England. There was, in the course of the 17th century, a number of innovations which placed petitioning even more centrally at the heart of a national political culture. And these events were largely centred around the outbreak of the Civil War in the 1640s, and also had to do with the great agitation over religion in that period, and different religious viewpoints were argued out both in print but also through petitioning. So one of the largest petitions of the 17th century was this massive 15,000 strong London petition for the root and branch reform of the church in 1640. And it was presented by a large crowd of 1,500 people and widely reported, and it placed a great deal of pressure on MPs. So in a sense, there's a sort of novel development. Whereas those medieval petitions had largely been generated towards the crown, in the 17th century, you see many more coming at Parliament and with an explicit attempt to try and put pressure on parliamentary discussions. And indeed, many MPs, both at the time and immediately afterwards, thought that the pressure of those mass petitions and the crowds that had helped to present them was one of the factors that contributed towards the drift to civil war. The other interesting innovation that goes alongside that in the 1640s, as the government lost control over the printing press as part of the slide to civil war in the early 1640s, the petition became a printed object as well as just a manuscript object. All those medieval petitions that the York Project were looking at were manuscript. In the 1640s, you have a mass of printed petitions, like this one from 1642 on the right-hand side. And a sociologist called David Zarrant has studied these and argues that, in his words, there are the origins of democratic culture in this process of printing petitions. For a number of reasons. Firstly, he argues that a petition no longer had a single person who was supposed to be responding to it. As soon as you print it, it involves the public in a discussion of the demands of the petition. So here on the right-hand side, you can see a petition and protestation of the County of Kent presented to the Honourable House of Parliament by Sir John Sedley. So its ostensible audience is the MPs in Parliament, but by virtue of the fact that it's printed, it is also asking the people who are reading it in its printed form also to act as judges of its content. And the second sort of key innovation that Zarrant points out is that these printed petitions become in dialogue, start a dialogue, and they're in conversation with one another. So one petition provokes a counter-petition, and the counter-petition then provokes another group to enter into that conversation with a petition of its own. So you start to generate a political or a politicized discussion, which is actually very hard to close down, because the participants are always wanting to respond to that ongoing dialogue. And there are interesting groups in the 1640s and then into the 1650s who take advantage of both print and of petitioning to develop new political agendas and new types of political community. And I suppose the most famous of these is the Levellers, who were radicals arguing for a systematic review of the way in which politics was conducted and who could be eligible to be involved in politics. And they are, in a sense, a petitioning community. There aren't that many of them if you analyse their numbers, but they have an impact way beyond the small physical community because of this print petitioning community, which extends much further. So they produce petition after petition, which is printed and which start to codify a manifesto of really interesting proposals. Later on in the 17th century, there is another interesting phase, if you like, of the history of petitioning, and it's one which coincides with the origins of party politics in Britain. So Whig and Tory first emerge in the 1680s and dominate the next 40 years in what contemporaries at the time called the Rage of Party, as these two parties really locked horns over a whole variety of issues, including religious differences, ideological differences, constitutional differences, differences over the place of Britain in the world, and so on. And the result of that contestation of different rival viewpoints codified and given a concrete form through the party system is that petitions become an intrinsic part of party politics in the late 17th and into the early 18th century. And just as the print world of the 1640s was doing something new, so in the 1690s and into the 18th century, there's a sort of strengthening of the notion of the public as the umpire of politics. It's no longer just necessary to appeal to a political elite. You have to appeal to and ask the public to decide on political issues. And that increases the role, I think, for petitioning again. And it's in this period that we see extremely extensive involvement in the petitioning process, and indeed in other types of what we might call subscriptional activity, moments when people signed their names to either to petitions or to addresses of thanks. That was another very popular genre where you thanked or gave thanks, say for example for a major military victory, or you gave thanks that a new monarch had acceded to the throne, or you gave thanks for a particularly joyous event. So that's one other mode in which many people signed up to documents, which then had a sort of national circulation. And the other really interesting form is this one on the right-hand side, which is an association, whereby people, in a sense, created a bond through the association with one another. So the association was promoted in order to guarantee that the community would respond in a certain way. So this particular document is from 1696. There had just been an assassination attempt on William III's life. And across the country, citizens signed up to this association, promising that if anybody attempted to take the king's life, that they would immediately take up arms against whoever dared to do that. And the extensivity of those campaigns is really quite extraordinary. If we take Norwich, which is in the late 17th century, Britain's second largest city, nearly every adult male signed one or other versions of the association that was being promoted in Norwich. And there were two versions that were circulating in the city, and there was only a single word that was different between them, and it's this word revenging, which may seem a very sort of abstract thing to involve the whole of the town's or the city's population, but went to the heart of debates about how far it was lawful to take up arms in order to make your point. And this split the city into two, creating this hugely extensive involvement. But if the First Age of Party involves many people in subscriptional activity, it's nothing really to the takeoff that we see at the end of the 18th and into the 19th century. Number of factors occurring from the 1760s onwards, with the Wilkite agitation in London over reform, war with America in the 1770s, issues about Catholic relief in 1780, antipathy to the slave trade in the 1790s, parliamentary reform in the 1790s and then through into the 19th century, and so on. Lots of these issues generated really massive amounts of petitioning activity. And the scale is unprecedented. Just really eye-watering numbers of people start to become involved in these campaigns. And you can see from this table the takeoff in the numbers. We can chart that even more precisely because these petitions were very often presented to Parliament. Some were presented to the House of Lords. Overwhelmingly, they get presented to the House of Commons, and very luckily for us, lots of that material is catalogued and tabulated. So we can be pretty confident that that our figures here are reasonably correct. And you can see not only that there's a rise in the amount of petitioning, but that some of those petitioning moments are extremely involve an extraordinarily large number of people in that type of activity. And that graph comes from a project which I'm tangentially involved with colleagues at Durham, where they're looking at the whole process of petitioning from the early 19th century through to the early 20th century. And in that period, there are 1 million petitions presented to Parliament, with something like 165 million signatures. And in a sense, the scale of petitioning becomes a problem, because Parliament just can't process this very large number of petitions, which is flooding in on it. In the 1830s, the late 1830s, and then finally in 1842, they take a resolution actually that they're not routinely going to read all the petitions. Some people call this a sort of parliamentary gag, but actually I think that graph that I just showed you shows that actually there's only a relatively muted impact of that initially. So you can see that although in the 1840s there's maybe a slight little dip, it's not really fundamentally affected. So even though Parliament tries in some ways to close it down, it can't, and people still flood the House of Commons with petitions, largely because they've become an extraordinarily powerful political tool. They're incredibly good at raising public awareness of particular events and of involving the public in those events. They're also capable of sort of rather dramatic, sensational campaigns. So as the period progresses through the 19th century, although the overall number of petitions tends to decline, you get these extraordinary moments when petitioning is used for monster campaigns, single issues which will attract very large numbers of people. You can see that in this graph here, where those spikes represent extremely large numbers of people. So the top line across there is 6 million signatures. So we're reaching really, really extensive proportions, but for relatively small numbers of campaigns. So in a sense, the political culture is evolving because people are targeting these in interesting ways. So I've been arguing so far that petitioning is really a very important constituent part of a vibrant and inclusive political culture. You could argue that it's superseded by enfranchisement and through the modern democratic process, that as soon as you have everybody signed up to vote, that the level of petitioning decreases. It's not quite as simple as that, but I think there is something to that relationship. But until the early 20th century, petitioning had been this routine, customary way of getting things done. It's not just a one-off event like a referendum. It is an ongoing process. It's an ongoing dynamic contestation of politics and of key issues. And it gives a voice nationally as well as just to particular groups. And here in this image, you can see the counties with their large rolls of petitions, each one presenting their own version, often with their own design text, which is subtly different from other locales. So there's a way in which the localities also find a voice through this national process. And petitioning then enables the plurality of the voices of the people to become apparent as part of this sort of ongoing dialogue between petitioners. And the gathering of hands to these really vast petitions is itself constitutive of a political community. The process of gathering hands to a petition generates a notion of political community. So the process of petitioning, I think, has hugely beneficial consequences for the health of the political debate and its activity. So I want now really to turn to other dimensions of petitioning and perhaps the more legal aspects of petitioning, and to think about petitioning in terms of a right and how far there is a right to petition that goes alongside this expansion of the petitioning world that I've been outlining. And it's an interesting one because the legal status of petitioning is contested throughout the period that I've been talking about. And it's highly ambiguous. The first statements about a right to petition are made in the 1640s. Initially, it's a favourable judgment. In 1642, the House of Commons passes a resolution talking about the right to petition as being an ancient right. But the petitioning that erupted in the 1640s immediately causes politicians pause for thought. And as early as 1648, Parliament declares that there is no right to petition, and that actually petitioning can be seditious and tumultuous. And so very early on, there's this conflict between the traditional customary right and the idea that mass petitioning in particular has a seditious and, or in 17th century language, a tumultuous nature to it, which threatens the political process and therefore has to be in some ways controlled or contained. Petitioning that I was talking about in associated with the first age of party is also interesting because the revolution of 1688, the so-called Glorious Revolution, which attempted through the Bill of Rights to codify some of the rights and privileges of freeborn Britons, did argue and does state that there is a right to petition the Crown. It says nothing about the right to petition Parliament. So even at this massive constitutional moment, there is still ambiguity because there is no statement, legally binding statement in a constitutional document which says there is a right to petition Parliament, which consequently means that for much of the 18th century and into the 19th century, it remains a contested and contestable right. So that in 1795, during the French Wars, the Crown and Parliament decide to try and clamp down again on petitioning and printing activity and to close down those mass meetings which were generating petitions. So this remains a very debated and fractious right. And yet it goes to the heart of really interesting debates, I think, about the nature of popular sovereignty. If the people are sovereign, how do they express that sovereignty? Is it just through elections, or are there extra-parliamentary mechanisms by which the will of the people can be voiced? And if so, what's the extent of those, and how legally binding are they? The contest over the right to petition then was, in a sense, a much larger debate about political rights more generally, and therefore it almost necessarily was seen as a confrontational debate from the parliamentary point of view, because Parliament saw this as a rival voice of the people, just as we've had rather interesting debates about the nature of the referendum as a sort of rival voice of the people. And so you get an interesting debate across this period of whether petitions are actually a better barometer of opinion than MPs. And some people argued that they were, and so in 16 1767, for example, a tract claims that petitions represented the real and universal sense of the people, much better than parliamentary elections, which in the 18th century were infrequent and very frequently corrupt. In 1793, a rejected petition from Nottingham in favour of reform claimed that the country didn't really have a proper parliament at all. It was simply amused with the name of representation of the people when the reality was gone. So particularly at a time when many radicals see parliament itself as a corrupt body, petitioning becomes a really important alternative way of expressing the will of the people. There are many others, however, who see that attempt to give the extra parliamentary voice that type of status as highly dangerous. Lord North, the Prime Minister in 1780, argues that the voice of the people of Great Britain could be heard only from that house where it was spoken by their representatives. And at exactly the same moment, and this is in the wake of a huge petition which was presented by Lord Gordon against proposals to give Catholics some measure of emancipation, which had led to widespread rioting in London and enormous damage. Sir Peter Burrell, MP, if petitioning was allowed to dictate to the House, the liberty and constitution of Parliament, he said, would be annihilated and gone forever. So there are very different views about whether petitioning was a legitimate alternative to the parliamentary franchise. And those debates, I think, also swirl around in other interesting ways, because if it's right that you can petition Parliament, and therefore you should surely be able to petition your MPs, couldn't you then petition your MPs at the time of the election and insist that they then adhered to the demands of the petition which they accepted at the time of their election? In other words, couldn't you use this mechanism to convert representatives into delegates who accepted the texts of the petitions that were being outlined? And there were very frequent attempts to do exactly that in the 17th and in the 18th century, and a big debate about whether MPs were delegates or representatives. It's much more extensive than the Bristol debate, which is associated with Burke in the later half of the 18th century. It's far more persistent than that. It's a really ongoing debate that people had. And it's also, the petitioning debate spills out even more widely than that, because if there is a right to petition, and if it is a possible alternative to Parliament, what are the duties of the person who is being petitioned? And what happens if they just simply ignore the petition, rather, as we've just seen with that 4 million petition on the Brexit, they really basically say, well, we're not going to really address that. Is that then a violation of the political powers? Is that a violation of the rights of the people? Here's this rather nice demonstration of the Prince Regent in 1819, and you can see he's been very, very favourable to some rather fawning addresses on the left-hand side of the image, and he's farting in the face of the radical petitioners who are agitating for reform on the right-hand side. So he's not listening to these guys at all. He's only listening to the people that he wants to listen to. So can you hold both Crown and Parliament to account if they simply ignore the petitions that are being generated by the people? And that leads into an interesting discussion about, if they do ignore it, can you then legitimately take up arms against authority, because it's, in a sense, abnegated its proper duties, or indeed maybe oppressing you? This is an image of Thomas Dare, who presented a petition in 1680 to Charles II, urging him to let Parliament sit during a crisis called that was around the Popish Plot. And living up to his name, when he's challenged about how he dare present this petition, He says, I can either petition or I rebel. And that's an interesting conundrum, because if you close down the right to petition, where do you leave the popular voice? Where does it find its expression, and does it then find its voice in more direct action? So there are anxieties about this, particularly at revolutionary moments. In the 1680s, just before the revolution of 1688, caused by the American War in the 1770s, and again by the French War in the 1790s, a persistent theme. And in turn, that's influencing some interesting political theorists who are themselves petitioners. This is the signature of John Locke on a petition from 1680, part of that same campaign that Dare was involved with. And Locke articulates in his two treatises a version of resistance theory. So there are debates about what sort of right, if a right it was. Was it a statutory right? Is it a natural right? And interestingly, what sort of other rights might go alongside the right to petition? So in 1781, Christopher Wyvil argues that if the people have a right to petition Parliament at all, they must have a right to meet and consult together in order to exercise that right in a peaceable and orderly manner. So freedom of assembly is one of the constituent rights that goes alongside the right to petition. So is the freedom of the press, because if you've got the right to petition authority, you must have the right to print and publish and disseminate that public appeal. So there are some very interesting debates, I think, at the sort of level of political theory that petitioning generate. So I've argued really that petitioning gave local representation a vibrant place in the political culture of the pre-modern world. It's a routine way of getting things done, but it's also a way of getting extraordinary attention for particular campaigns. And it's able to represent the plurality of the public will. It's able to represent more than one public will. The public will in the petitioning world is not a settled will. It's a contested will. It's a dynamic will. And the petitions give a voice to views in a way that could, at times, exert real pressure. One needs to think about the torrent of petitions against the slave trade, for example, to see the impact that these campaigns could have. And I want to close really by just wondering whether e-petitioning has quite the same function as the petitioning that I've been talking about. As I was suggesting earlier on, the way in which the pre-modern world constituted community through petitioning was an extremely important part of that political culture. It involved more than just signing your name. It involved being doorstepped by someone who was intent on procuring your signature to a document. It relied on people debating and talking about the issue that they were going to sign. It involved neighbours putting pressure on neighbours and interacting with neighbours. It involved communities responding to other communities and keeping a very close eye on what those other communities were doing. And in a way, e-petitioning is a sort of much more rarefied, much more abstract way of that petitioning process. I'm not saying we shouldn't have it, because I think in many ways it's an interesting constitutional experiment. But it, for me, I don't think it quite captures some of the constitutive element of that political culture from the pre-modern world.